Hello and welcome to episode 10 of Teaching Here and There, the podcast about hybrid teaching in higher education. I am Dom Pates.
And I am Ivan Sikora.
And I'm James Rutherford.
And in this episode today, we are talking to Tessa Rogowski, a senior director in the IT directorate at the University of Essex, and Mark Glynn, the head of teaching enhancement at Dublin City University. We get to look out across the sectoral landscape and see what else is going on in a few more institutions in higher education. So as we say, let's dive straight in and get into the conversation.
Thank you very much, both of you, for joining us today. Tessa and Mark, perhaps I could ask you to introduce yourselves. Firstly, you, Tessa.
Tessa Rogowski, I'm the Director of IT Customer Experience at the University of Essex. My current responsibility is for all of the physical infrastructure of teaching and learning spaces in the university, which is about 20,000 students. Previously, I was also responsible for all of the learning systems that in effect were driving or being used to exploit the benefits of the spaces we have. That's no longer in my remit. And we have been doing increasingly less support of the actual pedagogy that underpins all the technology I've been talking about.
Okay, thank you, Tessa. Mark, welcome.
Thanks, James, and thanks, Tessa. My name is Mark Glynn. I'm the head of the Teaching Enhancement Unit within Dublin City University. And our role is to support academics in the enhancement of curriculum. So to look at curriculum design, professional development of staff, but also learning spaces, both virtual and physical. So we're responsible for all the learning technologies, of Moodle, or VLE, Zoom, the virtual classroom, but also the physical learning spaces and hybrid spaces.
Great, thank you very much. So both of you are ideally placed to answer some of our questions about hybrid teaching. And we may well refer to previous episodes where it's relevant, but it'd be very interesting to get your perspective, certainly from a position of what's going on in Ireland, but also from a technical background as well, Tessa. So first question, if I can ask you, is how did you first become involved in supporting hybrid teaching?
So we've been looking at it for quite a while because we've got multi-campuses here. So we actually do some teaching across campuses. And when I came here, I inherited a very suboptimal arrangement that allowed students to be in one classroom and the lecturer to be in another classroom with all the students there. I'm very pleased to say that gradually got so poor that we shut it down. We then looked to what we should do and had been toying with a number of technologies. We'd started using Zoom Rooms as a sort of path in to finding a resilient technology. We used those first in meeting spaces and were beginning to roll it out into teaching spaces when the pandemic hit, and at which point we turbo drove all of our installations that we'd learned how to do across meeting spaces into teaching and learning spaces. And that all of that work was done across a large number of rooms in the summer of 2020.
Right. And that's, you said, about 200 rooms?
Yes, that's the top 200 teaching rooms. Right. They were all enabled for audio, video and Zoom capability.
Right. OK, thank you. Mark, how about you? How did you first become involved in supporting hybrid teaching?
Well, it was while I had black hair. It's now giving me grey hair. But it was a few years ago, similar to Tess, we had staff interested in doing hybrid, or what we call high flex teaching. We had relationships with Arizona State University, where we had a room full of students in Arizona and a room full of students in DCU, and we co-taught a particular module, true high flex teaching. And then we also had other initiatives where we had students joining in remotely into some live classrooms. And ironically, as it turned out, some of our students who were on campus decided they preferred to join in remotely and went to a library room to join in on the teaching within that particular classroom because they had such a strong preference for the benefits that HyFlex affords. So they were our two main examples of HyFlex, and then COVID happened. And obviously that scaled up dramatically, not to the extent as Tess. We upgraded 16 different learning spaces and teaching spaces. And then we also had an additional, if I remember rightly, 5 different laboratory spaces, which we upgraded to HyFlex.
Interesting. And that's something we might want to come on a bit later, is in terms of applying hybrid technology to practical courses, or if you talk about labs, yeah, it'd be good to pick that up later. But over to Dom.
Yeah, thanks, James. And Tess and Mark, it's really great to be in this conversation with you. Thank you very much for joining us. A couple of really interesting stories from you both to kick us off there as well. I mean, Tess, are sort of a massive operation by the sounds of it that you've had to contend with as well. And Mark, really interested to hear that you've done work with Arizona State as well. They're a very interesting institution that do sort of push the envelope as well. So I'm really looking forward to this. So my question is around your experiences of integrating technology into your learning spaces. And perhaps we'll do this the opposite around. I'll come to Mark and we can go to Tessa. What kind of issues did you come across? And how did you solve them? It's a fairly simple question in a way, but probably multi-layered in the sort of responses. And as you've both indicated, there's been work that you've done prior to the pandemic, and then you would have had the supply chain joys and everything else once that happened as well. So, Mark, what was it like?
So it was definitely interesting, an interesting process. We had a mixed experience, if I'm honest. We had staff fierce enthusiastic about it, wanting to bring it in, but were using their own setups, which was very varied, to say the least, and some of them quite poor quality. They were using their laptop microphones or using a USB plugged-in device for us, a small camera, and any time they moved away from the podium, nobody could hear them or see them. So we very quickly, when we decided as an institution, when we decided we were going to do HyFlex teaching, we decided we would do it properly and we would invest in specific rooms and set up with a minimum standard of technology to be used that would be funded centrally by the university, a minimum standard to be used. And that's what would be called HyFlex teaching. That's what would be called HyFlex classrooms. And that was a significant investment from the university, but also a statement from the university to say, this isn't going away. This isn't going away after COVID. And then our problem became with the technology is to try and make it as simple as possible for staff to use, trying to remember the pedagogy and be led by the pedagogy rather than be led by the latest shiny toy of technology as to what's there. So they were the challenges that we had, but what we're now 3 years in, 4 years into our journey into HyFlex, which, as I say, has ramped up dramatically since COVID, I'm happy we're in a good place, but I don't think we've got it perfect just yet. Just yet. We're still on a learning curve.
So on the route towards perfection, but with a lot of lessons on the way there.
Exactly. And lessons and grey hairs and a couple of ulcers thrown in too.
I think we're probably all feeling exactly that as well.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mark. That's brilliant. Tessa, how about you? You've got a scale story with for yours.
Yes, we have run out at scale, and it wasn't as though we went from nothing to 200. I should have given some background. We started many, many moons ago creating a service we called Listen Again. We're very proud of the high percentage we have of students with specific learning differences. And we had an all-out effort to make sure that we had all the buildings blocks in place to do blanket lecture capture. And we started many, many moons ago and effectively introduced a university-wide policy, and we considered this utterly underpinning and key to it, a university-wide policy of opt-out, so that by default you recorded, but there was an elegance about how you could opt out. So when we did this at scale, we already had audio recording and certainly recording of the monitors, whatever was displaying on the projector in the majority of rooms. So actually, in the work we did for the pandemic was to improve the audio and get video capture in there again. So I think a lot of our problems, the really big wicked problems, we'd already more or less worked our way through. So having got that infrastructure in place, we rocked through those rooms, and the problems, of course, were the supply chain. We were fairly sure this was going to happen, and I think we were one of the few universities that managed to get the equipment that we needed in order to do it at that scale. And we went out with a tender really very early, and we also in the main self-installed, but that's just historically how we've always done it. We gives us a lot of flex in scale there. Sort of some of those solutions were already in place. I'd say the biggest problems we had, and I still think this, is our ability to train people how they might use this. Once we'd gone into any kind of lockdown, and it's no longer in effect, that sort of hybrid learning, because everything's remote. And I think it has had some long-term advantages, but specifically, we'd set some rooms up for really interactive hybrid learning and others up so that people could less interactively dial in, and simply very little of it ever got used. Mm. And that was... Well, that's just how it was, and everyone had the same problem. Mm. The other thing I think we're still working on cracking, and we summer 21, we went back and revisited the audio because we just weren't happy with how good in spaces that we were fully expecting to be using in the year 21-22 was sounding. So we've done a second bite of the cherry because simply audio was not good enough. Mm. And I think we now feel that we're in a good position. We've raised the quality of all of our lecture capture, which we will by default still do. It's all automatic. The lecturer, as long as they're walking, the right person walks into the right room, that lecture will be captured with zero intervention from them. Their cognitive load is then down to teaching brilliantly. And I know that when you've got a remote audience, it's that cognitive load, to my mind, particularly if either of the a number of students as large, is just simply too much, and it needs two people. And I don't think we should mess around with that.
No.
You know, that to me, you need somebody who is in effect managing the room and somebody delivering the teaching and learning. And I think conceptually for the university, that's quite hard to accommodate.
Yeah, that's a really good point, Tessa. In our project at City, we took the lead from Imperial College Business School, who created the post or the co-pilot. For them, it's a GTA, it's a postgrad student, sometimes an hourly paid lecturer, mm-hmm. and they act as the co-pilot, managing the room, as you say, managing the tech. And at City, we've done the same thing. So we've been recruiting students to act as co-pilots. Not an easy task management-wise, but very, very valuable in the room. So thank you for that. It's really interesting.
You yep. also mentioned the training challenge there as well. Something that we've certainly also wrestled with. You know, do you go in first experiential and get staff to immerse themselves in a hybrid space to fully understand what it's like to teach in one, or do you start at a really granular and technical level and go, this is how you operate the equipment, we found that the balance between that has been quite a challenge. Mark, you got something you wanted to come in, and then I'll hand over to Ivan as well.
Yeah, well, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly with Tessa's view that you do need that extra person in there, because it is difficult. Cognitively, it is very, very difficult to do hybrid teaching. to get a high flex teaching, to give the students, the remote students, the equal service that you give, equal service and equal attention that you give to the students in the class. You do not want the remote students to be treated as second class citizens. And that we shouldn't, as institutions, have a setup within our institutions that we automatically create second class citizens in our classroom. So we need to invest significantly in the technology, but also in the people, also to make sure we have that teaching assistant there or co-teacher there, whatever terminology you want to put on it. And Tess is right, conceptually institutions have a problem with this, but also financially people have an institution because it costs money. It's like the age-old problem where some senior management and institutions thought, well, online education is cheap. No, it's not. And it's not the cheaper version or the poorer version. It needs investment. So I wholeheartedly agree with Tessa. And Dom, just with regards to your point on the training of the staff, one of the best things we have done is actually put the staff in the students' shoes, put them in as hybrid participants and see how they get on. And then we show them how to use the technology. But the key for us is to make the technology as easy as possible. And literally what happens is when they come into the classroom at their designated time, 3 o'clock or 4 o'clock on a Thursday evening or whatever time it's scheduled, it just happens. It turns on, the Zoom room invite is sent out and the students can click on the link and join in and their faces appear on the TV at the back of the classroom. We don't want staff to come in and have to be plugging in various different cables and pressing 10 buttons and testing the microphone just before it happens. They just have to rock on up to the classroom and it happen. Because if we make it difficult, or more to the point, if we don't make it easy for staff, they will rightfully so resist the introduction of high-flex teaching because it is so cognitively challenging.
Yeah. Very fair points there.
Great. Yeah. Now, from the other side of the classroom, from the lectern, this is how we see it as a lecturer. So basically, I really agree with Mark and Tessa about the efforts that you've been doing in terms of inducing people to the system itself. Although we might have, I would say, aptitude for the technology, but we assume that we know everything about it. And that was my driver when starting talking about this long time ago with Dominic. But listening to what you said, Tessa and Mark, and maybe Mark, you can start with your answer to me. In this whole game, we have different type of professionals involved. We have academics, we have people like you, the rest of the people in this podcast who are actually technically savvy, and we have other professionals who are involved in university itself. So support, learning support people, other technical people involved. When we talk about the hybrid, learning, what do you think it's important for the other professionals to consider when we design the spaces? So basically, let's assume we have Zoom license, but how to wrap the space around the technology for the hybrid to happen in the most efficient or maybe most intuitive way, in your view? Mark, maybe, and then Tessa, if you don't mind.
A very interesting question, Ivan. For me, we need to lead with the pedagogy. We absolutely need to lead with the pedagogy, and for the technology to be optimized, it needs to be practically invisible. The challenge that you have when you're teaching in a high flex scenario is that you need to change the way you teach. You need to break up your classroom into chunks. You need to have particular activities that you can engage your students, both remote and those present. And while we know that's a great way to teach anyway, if you take a hybrid out of the equation, not an awful lot of our staff would do that. We mm-hmm. all have examples of staff that will go in and lecture for 50 minutes and nonstop and so on. But even something as simple as having breaks, design breaks within the class, just where you can look at the chat box and see what the engagement is, or where you can involve or prompt students that are coming in remotely. to have them scheduled and designed into your classroom is key. So it does involve changing the way you teach. That doesn't mean that you shouldn't lead with proper pedagogy. You absolutely should, but it's not traditional pedagogy.
So I think we mentioned that, sorry Tessa, before I let you speak. I think we mentioned in one of the previous podcasts exactly that we are going to change the ethos and also the way we are doing the things. But Tessa, would you say that the software manufacturers or people who are providing technology are keen to listen or to include the demands of the pedagogy in their tools? Because don't I think I'm right when I'm saying that all these tools are actually have become and have come to the market not intended for teaching necessarily?
So for various reasons, we now run Zoom and Teams. But primarily when the pandemic started, we were a Zoom site because we'd looked across the market and made that selection about 3 years earlier, and it was definitely best of breed then. Mm-hmm. And I'd say arguably is marginally still there. So we had selected it for primarily for meeting rooms, as I'd originally described, but with an eye on teaching in the future. Mm-hmm. And the one thing that I have to say, in fairness to Zoom, was they were faster to move than Microsoft on taking their product and saying, this is utterly, utterly essential for delivery of learning, and learning is important. And overnight, they increased our webinar licensing. I mean, they were responsive, not just in ignoring costs that they could have made a show about, but actually also adding features, which, standing back from it, I think would say were demanded by their customers. And at that time, their customers were almost entirely education. They'd already listened to their business customers, and there wasn't much the business customer didn't already have in the Zoom package. My perception is Teams has done the same. It started later, and I think it's catching up quite well. So as far as that side of the tech is concerned, quite impressed. I think people discovered how fast they could move. And that's not just developers and software, but also lecturers, IT professionals like me. You know, we didn't know we could go this fast. We just didn't know. Mm-hmm. So
we all had to move fast, didn't we?
Yes. I think we'll look back and say, you know, it was a game changer. We're all trying to find marginally good things. But yeah. I think the velocity with which we now expect ourselves and our customers to move has just... It's gone up. It's been logarithmic in our expectations.
Just Tessa, just to come in on that point, I think that's a fascinating point, and I totally agree with you. What we've found with other conversations in previous episodes of this podcast is that going back to what you were saying about the pedagogy, that it's all very well technology changing, new microphones coming out, you know, echo cancelling facility in Zoom and all the rest of it to make the tech become more appropriate for learning. But what you can't rush so well and so effectively is the evaluation of this, the effectiveness. People need time for it to bed into their curriculum to see whether this is the right approach. And I'm saying that from personal experience. I'm actually currently designing surveys for staff and students to ask, what has your experience been like of hybrid teaching? Mm-hmm. And that's not something we can rush. What do you think, Tessa?
What I would say is, yes, you can't rush it. And I think I'd go back to the point we were making earlier, which actually this is really, really very, very hard. And I think it's quite hard, not only on the lecturers and the GTA that may be helping them, but also the students. And there is something about a quality of experience. And I think it leads me to... say two things. One, be careful when you use it, because it simply may not be appropriate. It should all be driven by pedagogy. Yeah. And I'm really sorry, but I you know, I suspect there are some things that simply cannot be delivered in a high flex hybrid mode. And the other thing I think I'd note is it isn't a one size fits all, because when you do get into the pedagogy, we have spaces where we're just assuming it's relatively generic lecturing, but we also have a few spaces where we've just looked at how they wanted to teach, even if hadn't been built yet, and there was simply no way that that was going to fit into a standard space. So we did an awful lot of work with the client, which in this case was our STEM faculty, in understanding how they wanted to teach, what it is they wanted to achieve, and then fitted the technology around that and did a lot of iterative work, because some of this was quite complex, on the UI UX with them, as the user interface, the user experience. And that room won't work for an awful lot of people, but there's an awful lot of rooms that won't work for what they need to do. So I don't think that there is ultimately a one size fits all flex space.
Yeah, good point.
Yeah, I think that what we are hearing now, we have focused on the technology and on the IT side. How about the physical space? Being last week recording podcast at City University of London, I walked into the physical space that was actually made, adapted for the hybrid teaching. What would be, Tessa, yours or Mark's experience on how easy is to do that thing in addition to getting the appropriate software or the microphones? Yeah, please.
Yeah. So how difficult is it to work with a physical space? We're a 1960s university, so we're not Greenwich, which is a completely different nightmare. So we have challenges, but our estate, we know how to work through our estate now. So where we've got old rooms, we've got means of treating them when the technology gets worn out, but we actually have a program of renewal that goes through. And the space does get redesigned, but I think we work on around 10 to 15 years, probably nearer 10, before you get a physical change in space. And that, you know, that's three generations of students in effect. So it's not something that you can immediately change. You have to work with and around what you have and make the technology work for you. So we've got an awful lot of sound mixing going on in our more large rooms where people walk around and tend to walk out of microphone range. And we will, in rooms where we don't have carpeted floors and just very high reverberation, we'll be working around that problem by putting up acoustic panels just to take out some of that reverberation, which just makes the audio desperate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a really good point about audio. Sorry, Yvonne.
No, it's okay.
I just wanted to refer back to previous conversations where audio is one of the key factors in whether this is going to be successful or not. Mark, your experience of supporting hybrid teaching, you talked about your work in learning spaces as well. Mark, how do you view the spaces at DCU for hybrid teaching? And have you come to the approach of there are certain spaces that work for this and some that don't?
Yeah, there are certain spaces that work and others that work better. I would view all space on the campus as a learning space, whether it's corridor space, whether it's laboratory space or physical classroom spaces. So we're all the time trying to change our campus or enhance our campus to make it make these learning spaces better. From our perspective, again, if you're doing hybrids, we have a ceiling array microphones as opposed to podium-based microphones. We have Crestron Flex built into our podiums, and we've Crestron touch panels to be doing it. We have the ceiling speakers scattered throughout the classroom and PTZ cameras put in. We have processors, we have a confidence monitor for it to look at, which is like a 48-inch screen monitor. But then we have a 65-inch monitor there to show the participants as well, and the Zoom room license all built in. So all of that equipment is there. All of that IT needs to be managed, needs to have the appropriate networking available to itself. So we're challenged in our physical spaces, in more challenged in some of our older campuses and our older buildings than we would be in our more modern ones. All of that needs to be set up. And then when we go into our lab spaces tend to have high ceilings in them. And in engineering, they tend to be concrete ceilings. So the sound, we need to put in all the acoustic paneling around them, because yes, it's terrible for us, or I won't even say terrible, I'll say annoying to us to hear the reverb or whatever sort of poor sound quality it is, but we can still learn. Whereas somebody that has maybe autism can actually find that prohibitive to learning. The learning spaces, all learning spaces need to be upgraded. And getting back to your point with regards to some spaces being suitable and some not, there might be some science laboratories that you can't put on that equipment on the wall. So you can't have a screen, a monitor on every single desk, because maybe you have high benches. So there's no clear visible point or no clear point within the class where a monitor would be visible to everybody. Simple little stuff like that. But we have done it where we've broadcast from one room into another, side-by-side computer labs, and indeed computer labs, different parts of the campus, to allow synchronous teaching, to allow high flex teaching to go on. So it's not, we just need to reimagine the way we teach, and using high flex and the systems we put in for high flex has now changed our timetabling problem. Where we were having one lecture teaching the same class three times, three different groups were in the class three times because of capacity space, whereas now they can do it once, which means that the students don't have to come in at 9 o'clock in group A and 10 o'clock come in at group B and 11 o'clock group C. Now they all come in at 11 o'clock, which means they have a lie-in on whatever morning that is, Wednesday morning. But it also means that it frees up those two classrooms from the 9 to 10. So it has a really positive knock-on effect to the rest of the faculty. Even though we're not bringing in remote students, we're just doing high flex within our classroom structure.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear all these challenges. I just wondered, have you had any provision for the disco light in those classrooms?
You mean like a mirror ball or something?
I'll have to work on that. I only have one in my office. I don't have one anywhere else.
Dominic, I'm sure with all these connections to music and the disco lights, you might be willing to ask the next question.
I certainly am. And I'm going to go not to mirror balls, but crystal balls instead. There's a radio link for you there. whichever one of you wants to come into this first. So we've spoken about the range of different kinds of equipment that and tools that we'll put into our spaces as proxies for eyes and ears and mouths for those who aren't there or those who are there, for conveying them into different spaces. Our cameras of the eyes and the speakers of the ears and all that kind of stuff. And this is how we design these spaces at various different levels at this point now. Look at your crystal balls, though. We're thinking to the future, and obviously in your response, you define what you mean by the future there, whether you're going to choose a horizon of 5 years or 20 years. What do you see coming next, later down the line, in terms of hybrid delivery models? Obviously, right at the moment, we've got the going back to normal consideration. We've got the sort of hybrid living and working in hybrid events questions going through society at the moment as well. We've got questions around accessibility. There's all these new and emerging technologies that come through as well. So what do you see as the future in higher education in terms of hybrid delivery models?
I think the future is bright. I don't think it's as bright as some people say. If you cast your mind back to When TV came out, they said it'd be the end of radio. When radio came out, they said it'd be the end of print. None of those have happened. So I don't think it's the end of the classroom just because HyFlex is there. I do think that it will give more flexibility both to individuals, staff and students, and also to institutions. I think when we came back to campus, we didn't come back to normal. When we came back to campus, and there was a big clamor for us all to get back to campus after COVID, but the students didn't want to come back to campus to come to a lecture theatre with 200 of their colleagues in there. They wanted to come back to campus to the college experience. They wanted to come back to the campus to experience Third Level and everything it has to offer. A load of them, a very, very high percentage of them, said, we still want to have our recordings of our lecture. We still want to have the option to have the HyFlex logging into it. And that's illustrated by our poor engagement and our poor attendance records across the entire campus.
Yeah.
But our campuses are full, but they're just not going into the classrooms. So I do think there is a great future for it. I think now we have the infrastructure, a lot more of our classrooms. And earlier on, Tessa said we were moving at such high speed. And if I use a car analogy for this, we were using at high speed and people were traveling at 100 miles an hour that normally would have only traveled at 40 miles an hour. But we're not always going to travel at 100 miles an hour because we will run out of petrol very quickly. And we will run out of energy very, very quickly. And when we travel at 100 miles an hour, we miss the beautiful surroundings that we're passing by. We miss the time to stop and reflect and see what's going. So we need to slow back down. We need to slow back down and evaluate, using what James was saying earlier on, evaluate what works with hybrid and what doesn't work, and then make the necessary investment both in staff and in infrastructure to make it happen where it's meant to happen. But we need to take time and slow down and not try run at 100 miles an hour all the time. Because remember, again, sticking with the car analogy, there's still people that never wanted to get into a car before in their lives before COVID happened, but now they're in it and they're quite enjoying the journey. We can't force them to be traveling at 100 miles an hour either. Let them go back to traveling at 20 miles an hour or 30 miles an hour. They're still going further and faster than they would have before COVID happened.
Got some great metaphors coming into this conversation as well. And James, the speed up to slow down to speed up. It's nice to see your maxim added in there as well. Tessa, to keep the metaphors going, we've had a little bit of a bright side there. Are you going to give us a darker view of the future?
Can I say I agree with an awful lot with what Mark is saying. So you said, where are we going in the future? Well, in the immediate future, we are going to see less hybrid learning. That was to a certain extent forced on us by circumstances, reduced classroom numbers, et cetera, et cetera. So we're going to see less because one size fits all simply isn't the case. Then where will it go maybe over the next 5 years? And I think that's where I also actually boringly agree with Mark, which is it will find its rightful place. There will be places where it will work. And I can think of a number of our health and social care areas where if we get an expert in, we are very, very lucky and we will pile people in from any campus we can and make that the best experience because these people are kindly giving of their time. But my feeling is the curriculum will tell us what it wants. And I think in the future, there will be a lot less of us doing IT to people and people knocking on our doors and saying, I want to do this. Can you make the IT dance to my tune? I think one thing I will say I hope happens, I can't say it will, but I hope happens is that very large lectures won't happen again. I have never, it is so rare that those are a good pedagogical experience. And I think those are the kind of things that really, really lend themselves well to going into some kind of webinar format where you've got somebody chairing sharing everyone online. And I think that works really well for students. And that, I think, will certainly for us open up opportunities to do more responsive things in large teaching spaces, which we do not have enough of, and effectively rip out chairs and say, right, you, Mr. Expert Lecturer in whatever you're an expert lecturer in, you wanted this kind of space to teach in. And I think that iterative design will allow us to reduce the density of students in spaces. And I think that's longer term, and that's a guess, it's not a no, but that's what I think.
Pretty light, I think, after all. Although, despite the nail in the coffin of the large lecture. Mark, you had a response you wanted to come in on.
Yeah, I again agree with what Tessa has said there. The challenge that we're faced with is we're still building these large lecture theatres with the fixed seating. And part of that, the driver, is for us to get more bums on seats. The decisions are being made by the money people, not by the teaching and learning people. Not by the people that know how to do the job. So that's the challenge that we're faced with. I totally agree with Tessa that that's what we need to do. And I love seeing more of it. But it is a challenge we're faced with.
Tessa.
I have speculatively put into our forward years planning the redevelopment of a large teaching space per annum, some of this iterative design and learning as we go along. It's entirely speculative. We don't have timetables yet that prove that space will even be available. But I am really hopeful, much as somebody somewhere might think bums on seats is a good idea. I have great faith that higher education has more integrity than that, and actually we want to give great learning. So that money is reserved in our long-term capital, and I'm wanting people to come knocking on my door asking me to spend it on them.
It's the ever going, the ever moving dance between the business model and the need to transform people's lives.
And it's not, I think, isolated for the education. I'm from aviation and safety, and we're always fighting in between the budget restraints and safe flying. And don't worry, we are flying safe. Yeah? So we have asked you so many questions about the hybrid teaching, and the discussion was quite interesting. And I think, at least for me, it was very informative and educational. But I just wonder, like we always ask people in our podcast, is there anything in particular that we actually haven't asked you and you would like to share with the listeners or with us? Tessa, and then maybe Mark.
Yeah, I think there is something we haven't you haven't asked us, and I'm not sure I could answer very well, which is what do the students think about it currently? Mm-hmm. And what do they want? And I think if I refer back to Mark's, the speed at which we're going, our ability to talk to students and say, phew, well, that's over. What went well? What didn't? We haven't done that yet. And I have informal conversations with students on the campus and regular meetings with the VP, the Students' Union of Education. But seriously, I don't think we've got near doing that reflective piece with the students.
Do you think that they compare the experience in the hybrid with the experience on the YouTubes, Netflixes and the Amazon Primes?
I genuinely don't know. I don't think they do, but I think that will be down to the individual lecturer.
It's a very good point you make, Tessa, and we often ponder what's on the student voice. How do we capture the student voice? At City, we've got ethics approval to gather some research, do some evaluation of staff and students. So hopefully in the end of the summer, we'll be in a good position to publish some of that research and those outcomes.
Yeah, with us here, we have at University of West London, we have the evaluation survey of each module. And now the variant that we are using this year includes some of these questions. Yeah.
My feeling about these surveys is that So we have managed to put our annual survey out where we ask things of burning interest, but they tend to be fairly binary, very large sample sizes. And actually, I think what we need to do is the more subtle qualitative, not quantitative analysis of what's going on. And I'd also very, very much like to see, so we run a learner analytics system. I'd very much like to see if the learner analytics can prove anything, and I doubt it can because the data is so messy, can prove anything about the different learning modes.
And the engagement,
Just to follow up on that, Tessa, absolutely right. I totally agree with you. We've the survey that goes out is the broad brush, and then we've got the fine detail coming from some focus groups we're going to run with students. And that'll be really, really interesting. Mark, you wanted to come in there.
Yeah. God, we could have about 10 different podcast episodes out of this, let me tell you. But,
we book one more for you.
One thing that we didn't talk about that I actually think is part of the future of it, and it would definitely be my preferred future of it, a problem that we have, the student feedback has told us, we loved having the recordings. We loved being able to see the screen and not from the back of the class because they could see it right in front of them. And they gave all of the benefits of having the online recorded lectures, the ability to ask questions anonymously, all of the super stuff that you could get from it. And what I'm afraid of is that people will go towards lecture capture systems, which is not as good an experience if they purposely recorded video content for it. So if they went into a properly spec'd out recording studio and recorded material that they can use again and again and again. And that's the way I would like to see people go, because that then gives students real flexibility, proper sound quality, proper image quality, properly designed interactions within the content, not sticking a PTZ camera at the back of the class and capturing somebody stuck to a podium or virtually stuck to a podium.
CCTV, isn't it?
Yeah, which is what institutions tend to do. And I'm not simply talking about my own, because I'm actually really happy with the volume of investment they have done. Although I'd welcome more if the bosses are listening. But the fact is that if we are going into this space, let's go into it properly. Absolutely, let's go into it properly and stop trying to see it, oh well, the glass is half full, it's okay, it's half full. Well, it's not, it should be full. We should be giving proper quality experience to people.
Thanks for sharing the thoughts, and of course we have noticed the desire to be again on our podcast, so yeah, we'll schedule one. Dominic.
Yeah, I was just going to respond to Tessa's point as well about talking to students with a perhaps final thought before we wrap up as well. One of the things that we've been longing to do as a podcast team is to bring students into this particular podcast and ask them and talk to them and find out from them. And it's been quite challenging because in many ways we're that much further removed from students themselves, and it makes it a lot harder for us to just walk up to them and go, well, you know, would you like to talk about hybrid teaching on a podcast with them? However, the aim is still there. So I suppose I'll bring this to a close with the firm advocating of the importance of reaching out and getting the student voice in here as well.
Thank you, Dom. So we've come to the end of this episode. Thank you both very, very much for your contributions. It has been fascinating, as we say every episode, but the more opinions, the more experiences shared, the better. And Mark, you're absolutely right. We could have a few more podcasts based on this conversation. But just like to say on behalf of Dom and Yvonne, thank you, Tessa. Thank you, Mark. We look forward to talking to you again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And thank you as well. It's nice to share sort of war stories.
I say every episode that I love these conversations because I find out so much from other people that what else is going on out there. I also find that it affirms what we're doing in our own institutions and practices as well. So as we usually end these episodes, we're going to do a round the table for a single wrap up each, one reflection from those particular that particular discussion. I'll kick off. One thing that I really liked was Mark's media analogy, where he talked about TV was supposedly the killer of the radio, but radio continued after that. And it was the same thing with all manner of other subsequent mediums that followed. And the hybrid classroom is not the end of the classroom in Mark's perspective. It's perhaps an evolution of it. Ivan, what's your one key take from today's discussion?
Well, I enjoyed thoroughly the discussion. First, I had to capture the accents, and we covered from east to west, so it's nice that I learned another accent. But the point that you've made just a moment ago, Dominic, is actually that the classroom is not going to be killed, and that is what Tessa mentioned, and I love that approach of looking forward, and maybe not in a crystal ball, but planning for the remodeling of the classrooms that are adjusted or adapted or even designed for the hybrid learning and teaching. Because as we know, and even during our previous episodes, we have reinforced several times, it's just much more than technology that enables the hybrid to be as effective as possible. James, how about you?
Yeah, plan, do, reflect. That's coming back to me from some years ago. I think what struck with me, apart from the other comments that, as you say, Dom, were affirming and reassuring and shared pain as well, was the student voice. And we're very keen to hear from students of their experience of hybrid teaching. And I think both Tessa and Mark made the point that we really need to be listening to the students and hear what their experience is. Ultimately, this is all for their benefit and their learning.
So you have been listening to episode 10 of Teaching Here and There. We hope that you have enjoyed this particular episode and that you will join us for the next one. As with our customary call to action at the end, you can get in touch with us. We are on Twitter at @thathybridpod. We are on email at teachinghereandtherepodcast@gmail.com. And if you go to anchor.fm/teachinghereandthere, it's in the show notes, then you can leave us an audio message and we can even include it in a future episode. We've got plenty more very exciting episodes to come. But in the meantime, thank you for listening. We'll be back again soon.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Thank you. And we listen to each other and to you soon.
Teaching Here and There is a podcast brought to you by PSR Production. It's available to listen to on Apple Podcasts, Anchor FM, Spotify, and any web browser.